Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banatini, and here I discuss all things brain imaging with scientists around the world. Today, my guest is Dr. Andy Yan. Those of you learning MRI and fMRI analysis, which realistically should be pretty much all of us, may already know about the amazing resources that he's been prodigiously producing online, starting with Andy's brain blog in 2012 and expanding to videos, over 300 of them, and now his current project, Andy's Brain Book. Dr. Yan has been steadily creating a standard and a go-to resource for all of us to learn the nuts and bolts, as well as the concepts and nuances of processing our data. In this podcast, we discuss how he got started in all this, how perhaps failing to get a post-undergraduate position at the NIH started him down this path. We discuss the educational resources that he's been producing and how he draws upon luminaries from that range from Jacques Barzin to Dave Barry for inspiration. We also discuss the wider issues of education in neuroimaging, what can be taught and what cannot, and have an open-ended conversation on the future of neuroimaging, as well as on some of his own planned future projects. This was truly a fun and enlightening discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Today we have a special guest who does focuses mostly on education in fMRI, and you may have heard of him and seen his amazing stuff on his website. It started out with Andy's brain blog, Andy Yan. Basically, so I actually have done a lot of education. I've done not really a lot, but I've worked at the MGH fMRI course with Bob Savoy and MCW when they had their courses, but and also a little bit of UCLA. But I've sort of fallen away from the area of fMRI education. And when I was sort of researching what Andy's been doing, I was just blown away by two things. One, with what an amazing comprehensive job you've done, Andy. And secondly, I feel like the landscape of education in fMRI is sort of changing. Yes. It seems that there has to be a lot of a lot more basic processing and coding and things like that. And we'll get into that as well. So either way, welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we just get started with your background? So I saw on your website that you grew up in the Midwest, went to Carleton College, did your postdoc at Indiana, and then, got your PhD at Indiana and did your postdoc at the Haskins Laboratories. Mm-hmm. But going back I'm always intrigued with, if you can remember, what first motivated you to get into cognitive neuroscience?
It is an interesting question. And to be honest, when I first started college back at Carleton in Minnesota, initially I was thinking I was going to be a political science major or something like that. I didn't have any really firm ideas. Ended up switching to psychology as a major. Again, not with any really clear ideas, certainly no idea about what I'd be doing, you know, 15 years later or so. But I do remember at the time taking a couple courses, and, you know, it's a small liberal arts college. There's no scan center. There are no real neuroimagers who are on the faculty there. But we did touch upon some methods of neuroimaging. And again, this is that time, 2004 to 2008. And you see pictures of fMRI. You see pictures of, you know, EEG. I did find that interesting, but really what got me to where I am today, really set me on that track, was immediately after college. I had applied for a post-baccalaureate position at the National Institutes of Health my senior year of college, and this is how naive or arrogant I was, however you want to take it, but I was so certain I was going to get it. I thought the interview went so well that I didn't look for anything else. lo and behold, I get the notification. I didn't get it. I was shocked and devastated, knowing nothing about the job market or the skills you actually need to be competitive. But what happened was, after applying for just a few dozen positions, really just throwing spaghetti at the wall, applying everywhere, I finally landed a lab manager position at Ohio State University with Will Cunningham. And that's really what exposed me to neuroimaging, to scanning, to the whole process from designing the experiment to analyzing the data. So I was there on all of those different stages of it. And that's what really got me interested. And that's what really opened my eyes to what you could do with it. Is that that's what I would say really started it. And I can go into more detail about that if you want.
I'm kind of curious. Yeah, I mean, so definitely, well, doing your postdoc, you did do research as well. I mean, you're still doing, I think, research to some degree, but first of all, I have to say that it's our loss that it's amazing how random that is with post-baccalaureate is, just to talk about that a little bit.
I had no idea what I was doing at the time. I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, but still.
Who knows what would have happened if I had gone. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, the post-baccalaureate is our unique position at the NIH, and yeah, it is becoming more competitive. But and really, there is a randomness to it. It all depends on mm-hmm. the sees the lab. If they happen to find someone, you only have a certain slots. But still,
and by the way, no hard feelings at all. I'm not carrying a crutch about that. But at the time, I thought, oh, you just apply for something like that, and you probably get it. And yeah, happily ever after.
Oh man,
good learning experience.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And sometimes, you know, it's actually interesting. I mean, when early in my career, I was, you know, I majored in physics and I was going to try to get into industry. Maybe I was just thinking of that. And I applied for Abbott Labs in Chicago and they turned me down. And so if they would have accepted me, God, who knows how things would have been different. So I'm happy they did turn me down. Yeah. So you can always, in some ways there's a benefit from these sort of things. But so this was during, so you mentioned, where did you go again after you applied for the post-baccalaureate position then?
I was a lab manager at the Ohio State University with Will Cunningham.
Okay. And then you got into your PhD program at the University of Indiana.
Correct. A couple of years later.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And actually that's probably, in general, I recommend people take time before they start graduate school or medical school.
Yes.
Helps their perspective as well.
Definitely. Yeah. I found it very helpful because I was not only under the tutelage of a PI, and he gave me a fair amount of attention and training, but I was also around a lot of graduate students and postdocs and people, different levels along their career. And so I knew what I was getting into. I mean, I knew, what qualifying exams were, what, all the different phases they had to go through. So that was very helpful. And again, it's my experience. I would recommend it. Some people just know immediately what they're going to do, and great for them also. But, for someone who's not as certain, it doesn't help. It doesn't hurt at all to take a year or two or three.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, definitely. And there's no rush, really. I mean, and the fact is, once you get into graduate school, time kind of slows down a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
and you have more sunk costs in that regard. But if you ever want to get out, but anyway, so then you sort of saw a little bit of how one can benefit from setting up a structure where people are able to access and learn that sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. That's really where kind of the seeds were planted for what I'm doing these days. And part of my duties, it wasn't just to, help run subjects. And I was also doing some analysis too, which was nice. Not all lab managers get that much responsibility, but fortunately I did. But also one of my responsibilities was to help people with certain methods. And it's kind of the blind leading the blind. I'm not an expert by any means at that point. I mean, we're all learning continuously. But one of the, decisive moments was I'm trying to learn these things myself, and how do you kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps? And again, this is around 2008 to 2010. This is still before there's any concerted effort to standardize the way, for example, data is organized or analyzed. I think AFNI's still working on their AFNI proc, a PY script. And so everything on the message boards is totally customized and idiosyncratic. And it's just, I can feel the frustration of Bob Cox, not the rest of the people at a lot of times. But yeah. I came across a very short screencast. I think it was demonstrating something like doing slice timing and then before and after, checking it before and after. I thought this is really useful because it's like I'm seeing over the shoulder. Who knows who was narrating? It might have been Bob Cox, might have been Rick Reynolds. I don't know. But, you know, a minute video just showing you exactly what command they typed and looking at it in the GUI before and after. And yeah. I mean, to me, that saves me so much time. And there's really no question about how to do this. And it's not a very complicated command either. And so I thought this would be really useful to do for the other people in the lab who might need to know how to, I don't know, extract something with 3D bucket or how to set up a 3D deconvolve script, for example. And so that's when I was making these really rudimentary screencast videos. They weren't hosted on YouTube or anything like that, yeah. But these were all internally. We had a wiki, and that's where it started very early on.
Okay. Okay.
All right. It was AFNI. It was NIH. It was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they helped out.
It's interesting that you mentioned. So right. I mean, I was going back in your brain blog, and it looks like the first entry was during AFNI bootcamp, I guess.
Yes.
2012 in March. Yes.
Oh yeah. The good old days. Yes. I remember that very clearly. Yeah. Really strange. I don't know what made me want to blog about that specific workshop. I think part of it was, well, I was really excited about it, first of all, and I had a great time. And I was trying to document just a few things that we talked about. And also, you know, putting things online is useful because you can always come back to them. And also anybody else who stumbles across them can use them. So really the amount of utility you get out of it can be quite large.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where it all started. Yes.
Okay. So, so you're doing a postdoc and you're still doing your research, but then you're still sort of developing this. And then you did your postdoc at Haskell. Is there anything that sort of, and so all along you're blogging, you're generating momentum on this. And it seems that, so now finally you're in a position where you're sort of like, you're teaching, you're creating this, but you're also sort of like the lab manager or
right. Yeah. Throughout my graduate years at Indiana, yeah, I was wearing a few different hats. You know, I was obviously teaching actual courses like, you know, statistics and intro to psychology just to support my stipend. And then, yeah, around 2012 to 2013 were the kind of first videos walking through SPM and AFNI. And also doing research, yeah, at the same time. And they kind of mutually reinforce each other because, one, yeah. I was getting, you know, experience in the classroom, you know, public speaking, standing up in front of an audience, working in real time with students and trying to anticipate any issues they might have with understanding. How do we best explain certain concepts, for example? But also, as I was doing my research and trying to do certain analyses, I think, you know, things like beta series analysis or slice by slice analysis, things like that. I was just writing down what I was doing at the time. It wasn't very systematic at all. It really was in those days, really just kind of what was on my mind that given week. And then my goal was to write about at least once a week about whatever I was doing at the time. So there was a lot of material because I was still learning many of the basics. And I also want to acknowledge, in particular, a postdoc at the time who was working in the lab, Derek Nee, who's now a professor at Florida State University, I believe. And, you know, I had my advisor, Josh Brown, who was very helpful, and I had an excellent time in graduate school with him. But I was still seeing Derek most of the day because, you know, he was in the lab, he had more experience, and he would kind of walk me through not just the technical details, but also some of the more conceptual things about experimental design, statistics. And he was really a great resource. So I was able to extract a lot of information from him. And some of the material that I would put online was really just adapting some of the scripts that he had. So I want to give credit where it's due. And I think I did on a lot of those posts and videos. But so he really helped with a lot of the foundations of what I was doing at the time. I don't think he was really aware of what I was doing as far as putting materials online. And I wasn't really telling people about it. I just was putting it on there so I would have it, mostly for me to come back to it at a later point. So that's what was going on mostly through graduate school.
Okay.
And again, it really didn't feel like I was being overextended because, one, I liked writing about what I was doing. And second, it did save me a lot of time because, you know, I'm sure everybody's done this where you write in just a Word document, you save it somewhere on the computer about what you did, and maybe you give it to somebody else. But what I was figuring out at the time was if I not just put it online, but also record my screen for 5-10 minutes, just typing things out. I mean, it's there. I know that it worked.
Yeah.
I know for sure that this particular set of steps worked, and it actually made my work more efficient, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually a really good point, that the process of trying to actually, you know, not only learning it for yourself, but sort of learning it so that you can share it and then to iterate a little bit in terms of sharing it, I think really reinforces things and it makes you learn it at a level that it kind of pushes you to learn it in a level of detail and organize it in such a way that is much more useful and you remember it more. So I can totally see that.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right. So at Haskins, you shifted more from, so your research actually as graduate school was sort of focusing on anterior cingulate cortex, prediction, computational modeling, which is to me, just in itself is still a wide open area that's really fascinating, especially in the context of my own research of layer fMRI, trying to get more top down, bottom up sort of processing. But, and then at Haskins, they had, you know, these databases that I'm aware of in terms of pediatric databases. And so, right. And even there, all the more, I mean, so in the, and, you know, just to mention that it seems that more and more people, I noticed this at OHBM, are no longer even collecting data themselves. I would say at least half the people at the OHBM meeting have never collected their own data, but they just analyze these databases. And this is also where these tools are that you're obviously giving educational videos about and all everything else are incredibly, it's incredibly important to have this knowledge as far as that's concerned.
Yes. And I've heard many of the same things when I'm visiting different universities and just asking what people would really like to see, what they would like to learn how to analyze, and things like Human Connectome Project, things like there's the Adolescent Behavioral Cognitive Development Study, which has many different hubs across the United States, many different, open access databases like that. Well, you have to apply in some cases, but yeah, very large databases. A lot of people want to learn how to leverage those.
Yeah.
And this is getting more into some future directions that I'm trying to work on because I think it's low hanging fruit in one sense because there is a demand, and assuming people know the basics of how to analyze fMRI data, it's really just about doing it at scale and having the infrastructure and the tools to do that. So, and I know one of the, something later on we could talk about is more the future directions, but just to maybe get into that a little bit right now.
Yeah.
I have started working with it a little bit. So the data set I'm working with right now is ADNI, the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, and really nothing too complicated. It's simply using, I think, the CAT-12 toolbox to look at, you know, cortical volume and thickness differences between people with Alzheimer's and healthy controls, try to control for confounds like age, total intracranial volume. But the meat of it is, okay, let's say you download a few hundred scans from ADNI or more. Most laptops aren't equipped to do that, you know, right, at that scale. So you have to introduce people to cluster computing.
Yep.
Because especially at large universities, if you're a student, you probably have, at least at Michigan, you get kind of this starter pack of 80 terabytes and of storage and so on. And so learning how to use that and simply put everything onto there, mapping, say, a drive from your local machine so you can visualize everything that's happening on the supercomputer, learning how to use Slurm to submit jobs, and just knowing how to leverage that, I think, is going to be a really important tool in everybody's toolkit for the next 5 or 10 years. Because like you said, so many people aren't even collecting their own data anymore, but they're using these really large databases. And there's all of this discussion about, you know, with effect size and reproducibility, you know, the 20 to 40 subject range that maybe you and I are more familiar with that might be going out of style or just might not be, might be looked at more warily than it has before. Even though, you know, I have opinions about, well, if somebody has a really good experimental design and a real strong theoretical basis, that shouldn't matter that much. But I can see why there's a trend for people wanting to use larger databases.
Yeah, no, definitely. I've talked about this on some other podcasts as well, that, I mean, it does seem like the field, and there'll be more discussion on this even at OHBM. There's a live podcast, but but on the idea of, you know, I mean, this is sort of a tangential point, but and this might be relevant in terms of how to teach and sort of like at a higher level, like how do you ask the right question tailored to, you know, if you do want to extract individual differences, what do you do? Or if you do want to, compile all the data together to look at these, you know, large N effects, what's the best way of doing that? But then it's more of the line of how do you ask the right question and tailor that to the analysis that you use. So, so for instance, I actually think that small N is very relevant in some cases. It might not be for group comparisons of looking at some sort of, you know, biomarker of schizophrenia, for instance, with a small N. But then again, the large N kind of works. I mean, you know, there's that paper of BWAS that came out. But I really think that a big reason why it may not work as well is because there's more individual variants that we're necessarily accounting for.
Yes.
And I think there's a huge opportunity in developing tools for really pulling that out. And then obviously, so it would be interesting, and this is also, I'm getting ahead of myself in terms of instruction, you know, having, you know, a lot of people come in, you know, and who really benefit from your instructional materials. They don't really know what they're doing at all. They just want to get started.
Yeah.
But, and so they get started, but then they don't, then it's sort of like they don't really know, you know, generally what the best way to use these tools are, and sort of giving instruction on the principles of how to leverage certain tools in certain ways.
Yes.
Could be cool as well. But
exactly. That's something I do need to be very mindful of as I'm making these, because I do realize a lot of people use them to train themselves if they're relatively new to the field. They're designed that way to be accessible. They're by and large targeted towards newcomers or people who are in their first or second year of a graduate program, essentially things that I would have wanted to know when I was first starting out, just to make sure, because there are some things you do need to struggle with, understandably. Other things are simply obstacles that you shouldn't spend too much time on. You know, if there's just technical things about how to get fMRI prep working or anything like that, that shouldn't be taking up the bulk of your time. But as far as how do you, you know, make sure that people are learning what they're supposed to. It is something that I think about a great deal, because I don't want people to take all my materials as, you know, the right way to do it. And I try to put in caveats about how, you know, there's some debate, for example, do you do spliceotomic correction or do you include a temporal derivative?
Yep.
Some people say argue for one, some people argue for the other. Does it matter at all based on whether you're doing multiband? If you have sub-second TR, maybe it's a moot point, who knows? You know, other debates about including global signal regression, for example, what's the debate about that? You know, and some of these things, it seems maybe to some people, I guess, case closed, but really it's not. I mean, there's a reason why certain methods were developed over time, and it's worth looking into that.
Yeah.
What I think is the direction I'm trying to take recently, both I teach an fMRI course here at Michigan and also with any additional materials I'm creating, I really want to have people understand the history behind certain methods. A really good case in point is something like MVPA. You know, this didn't just come out of nowhere. There was a big back and forth between Jim Haxby and Nancy Kanwisher about, you know, patterns of activity. Does it encode information? Is it relevant? You know, what can it tell you about the functional organization, about different structures? And I think when you frame it in that way, one, it's easier to understand because, you know, just as humans, we kind of have this predilection for kind of narratives, right? I mean, that's just how we learn. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. But also, it gives you a sense of both why this thing was created in the first place. There were real motivations for it. It didn't just, you know, come out of nowhere. And second, it really informs you why they're making these variations and updates on it, like hyperalignment, you know, which is this really cool new variation of MVPA, which is very, very useful, but really helps to kind of set that into your mind conceptually. And also, I hope that it also helps people become more technically proficient as well, because you have just a more full understanding about the limitations and where it came from. That's how I want to approach it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think that I try to also do that in my, you know, I give talks about fMRI contrast mechanisms,
yeah.
But I always like to show the history because it really does lay out the context. And so when people understand more the context of kind of how it was developed, you know, they really, I think they even, they learn it quicker. They internalize it more, they make it more intuitive. And yeah, I totally agree with that. And even trying, I mean, I have to give you credit for, you know, the field of fMRI processing and even understanding the contrast mechanisms. I mean, it's massive. I mean, there's a massive learning curve, and you know, I'm still learning, and I'm actually falling behind in some areas in terms of trying to keep on top of things. I'm amazed with what the breadth of what you talk about and the detail, you know, it's impressive.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, I'm fortunate in that I have a natural affinity for it. I do really like digging into these things. And, you know, a lot of it derives from looking at a single data set from many different angles, right? I mean, even if you go back to, you know, Ken Kwong's original flashing checkerboard study, which is the foundation of virtually everything we do today, just understanding those principles will take you a long way. I mean, yeah, we come up with these really sophisticated designs, but okay, he started with a block design. What does that mean? And you get to event related, you get to mixed. What are the trade-offs? So I think really just taking pretty simple examples and exhausting a lot of the possibilities from it, as far as, you know, simple contrast, then from that going maybe to interactions. And from the same data set, maybe you have parametric modulation. You can always do FIR. What can that tell you? What data sets are suited for it? And I've been really fortunate to have, you know, started my career in an era where now we have these open access data sets. I mean, that's been a huge windfall for me, because now I can say, well, I want to teach people about parametric modulation. I've never, I did do a gamble task a long time ago, but it wasn't as well suited for what I wanted to illustrate. But we have access to Gamble's paper that was published in Science. Let's replicate their effects. Okay, great. I mean, and also that's really interesting for people to kind of replicate the classics. You know, if if you can download Haxby's original data and do the classifiers and then maybe do some of these updated classifiers, it's a lot more gratifying. You don't feel as lost because you know that there's this really robust result that, you know, that people have replicated before. So, I mean, start there, just get the confidence, know that you can replicate it, and also do some things that, because it's not your data set, go ahead and do some things that aren't, let's say, appropriate, you know, do some bias analyses, whatever, just understand it. I always come from the point of view that, you know, as long as you're not publishing it, just, yeah, get really cool effects that are probably bogus, but just, you know, and now you understand and now you know why you shouldn't do it. And you're probably going to be a lot more accurate at picking out when other people are doing it and when you yourself are doing it. Yeah. It's too good to be true. It probably is. You know?
Yeah. So you bring out a really good point that I was going to talk about too. It's like that, you know, you learn these tools, but that's, you're only, you know, halfway there. I mean, really the real learning comes from using the tools in different ways, mm-hmm. you know, trying to explore, you know, and also a big aspect of a lot of the analysis now is to be able to recognize artifacts, be able to recognize where things have gone wrong. And mm-hmm. that only comes, it seems like you can learn that intellectually in some sense, but until you actually do it and see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. And that is something you really can't be taught necessarily. You can meet them halfway. You can give some examples of, you know, spurious effects. But really, and it's hard to describe, but after a time, you know, if something is sketchy or probably an artifact. And,
yeah.
You know, there are ways to, you know, teach people to try to identify them, you know, not just by giving examples, but also it could be something as simple as just look at a completely unthresholded statistical map. And if, I mean, there's a certain way it should look.
Yes.
Regardless of whether there's actually an effect or not, you know, there's certain ways it should look. And if it looks, again, I can't really put into words, but you just have this feeling that, oh, yeah, no, that's not going to work.
You know, we generate our own internal models that we can't always verbalize. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. And so there's no, you know, maybe eventually machine learning might be able to recognize these things readily, but yeah. Right now it's all this human sort of, and actually there's just a paper that came out with Paul Taylor on, you know, being a proponent of having like unthresholded data, you know, always have it there as like a reality check. And also, you know, there's a lot of information there that doesn't necessarily pass threshold. I mean, thresholds in some sense, because the noise isn't perfectly, you know, understood, it's, the thresholds are somewhat arbitrary. Teaching people these heuristics, you know, trying to, you know, these just general ways of going about the data. I mean, that, you know, Bob Cox has always been a proponent of, you know, having AFNI is a great tool, and he purposely makes it non-black box like, you know, to mm-hmm. Look at all aspects, the temporal properties. You can also tell artifactual time courses by just looking at the temporal dynamics. I mean, if bold contrast happens too fast, it's probably motion. If it's, you know, you can see these things, and these things are just only learned from experience, it seems.
Yes. I mean,
yeah.
It is very complicated. And, you know, that's something I think about, because the ideal neuroimaging researcher, whether it's for fMRI, deep diffusion, what have you, would be fluent in MR physics, statistics, brain physiology, computer programming. And when you're trying to reach or, you know, address someone who may be an expert in one of those areas, but doesn't have a lot of experience in the other areas, how do you try to get everybody to a certain level at which, one, they're not making gross mistakes, you know, that they might be unaware of, you know, bias analysis, the kind of classic one. And two, just to get them on the same platform where we're all speaking a common language, you know, and there are some, you know, informal terms that are tossed around that I think, you know, bear some more clarification, elucidation, things like, you know, soaking up the variance. I'd hear that a couple of times when I was a lab manager. And I, at the time, I had no idea what that meant, actually. But it meant just including, you know, certain covariates, other aggressors that could plausibly explain some of the variability in the Bold signal, and make sure that you're accounting for certain confounds. Yeah, so that's always a challenge too. I understand that.
Yeah, yeah, and so I mean, what you said spurred a lot of other general questions, but actually, it brought to mind another question I wanted to ask you about this paper that you that. So I saw that you are, you know, co-author on this pretty impactful paper, and it's interesting, these papers, because they, you know, the popular press gets a hold of them, and then other people get a hold of them. And it's so the paper first author was Botnovic Nezer, and variability analysis of a single neuroimaging data set by many teams.
Right.
And so, yeah, you can probably summarize the paper way better than I can, but just my take on that was essentially, I mean, they had 90 groups do it.
Yes.
And their conclusions were, at least in terms of the results, was that, oh, we got a lot of different results from this. And they all are pretty good groups. It's like they all knew what they were doing. And so what is your take on, I mean, there are other aspects of the paper that were kind of like, okay, this is good, because then we can sort of collectively find a convergent sort of answer. That's a good take. But another take is obviously that, oh, my God, anyone does anything, it's like, it's how do you interpret this? So what, you know, especially in the context of trying to teach best practices, what would you?
It was a really fun paper to be on. And just to summarize it for the audience, and it's really not too complicated of an idea. They gave, again, it was something, many dozens of groups, 90 groups, something like that, the same data set, which was a Gambles data set, and we're looking at parametric modulation of gain and parametric modulation of loss. And it's been well established in the literature that you should see these loading onto things like nucleus accumbens, ventral medial prefrontal cortex, other regions associated with reward or, say, loss aversion. And so they had everybody analyze it, and they gave each of us the ability to define how we were going to say whether a result was there or not, significant or not. So you would define your region. I think I used the FSL Harvard Oxford subcortical atlas for like nucleus accumbens, for example. And we said, you know, if we find significant effects in there, then we're going to, you know, reject the null hypothesis, for example. And everybody did that. The, let's say, you know, controlling authors of the study, because I was just one of the people analyzing the data set and reporting the results, but the people who actually came up with the idea and took everyone's data, and we uploaded our unthresholded maps to, say, NeuroVault, which I think is an excellent tool for that. And they correlated each of these different groups to create this correlation matrix about how much overlap there was between different people's statistical maps. And I think it's figure two. They have this gigantic matrix of the correlation of every group with everybody else. So what was interesting is, you know, for the most part, I think roughly like 3/4 of the groups, something like that, had, you know, relatively good overlap of their maps. Others didn't find any significant results. Other people had it in the opposite direction. And so their takeaway was, it should be a more standard practice to have many different groups analyzing the same data set, just for the sake of reproducibility, for the sake of establishing checks on whether, for example, if one group gets something in the complete opposite direction, it suggests somebody has done something wrong at some point. Maybe just onset times are off, or something got, you know, maps are flipped, or they just misread it, for example.
Right.
So that was the gist of it. Again, really interesting idea. You know, I did encounter some people who thought that they were really trying to make this almost like a PR move for something like fMRI prep, because they did give us the option to either use our own imaging pipeline or use data that had already been analyzed through fMRI prep. Now, fMRI prep, it doesn't do any of the modeling for you, just as the pre-processing. So everything beyond that is totally up to the researcher. So it's not going to do all your analyses for you. But in any case, you know, I did it actually both ways. I have my own AFNI pre-processing preprocessing pipeline. I prefer AFNI. I grew up with it. And I found that fMRI prep does give you slightly more robust results, but the overall pattern is, you know, essentially the same.
Yeah.
So that's my summary of the paper. That was my experience with it. And yeah, I think it's definitely a good trend to have, how practical it is to have everybody have multiple groups analyze the same data set. May not be as readily available as they may hope, but I get where they're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting to do sort of a meta-analysis of this paper's results in general. I mean, sort mm-hmm. of like trying to, you know, take that data and maybe see how you can not really manipulate the data, but sort of, you know, if you like, for instance, lowered the contrast slightly or lowered
yeah.
slightly or mm-hmm. something like that, you probably would start to get more convergent results. But it's interesting to sort of maybe to use as a way of further teasing out, you know, what's truly the wrong analysis versus mm-hmm. what generally are the better analyses, or, you know, they purposely didn't make a judgment on that. But but yeah, it was an interesting starting point. I mean, like all these, like, you know, the BBOS paper recently, it's sort of like, it's a point that everyone kind of knows, and it's sort of like right in your face, and you're mm-hmm. like, okay, now what do we do? You know, then most people kind of like understand that, and they go on and they realize, okay, so we have to, it'd be great, right, to analyze, mm-hmm. have many groups analyze one data set, but that's also, you know, not completely feasible for everything.
exactly. Yeah, too many cooks, and
yeah, and so it's a tough question, and it's also, we're up against sort of this unknown of you know, there really is no gold standard necessarily. I mean, mm-hmm. there are things that come close to gold standards, but yes. even fMRI prep, I mean, that's mm-hmm. people generally agree with that. I think that the prep part, I think we can converge on a little bit faster, but sure. in terms of the contrasts and the types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yes. I know some people have reservations about using some of these standardized tools like fMRI prep, which by the way, if anybody listening is unfamiliar with it, it's kind of a standardized way, like we've been saying, about how to pre-process the data. So it tries to include what the developers consider the best tools for, say, you know, normalization, registration, and so on, to get the data as clean as possible. I think, it's an astonishing effort. This is by the Stanford Reproducibility Group, I believe. I hope I'm getting that name right. But, you know, Russ Poldrack and Chris Gorgolewski and people from that area. But I also understand if there's some people who just may not prefer that and feel that if it becomes expected, it could become stifling to, you know, innovation or the way that people want to use their own pipelines or their own sequence of pre-processing steps. I can understand that. And there's also a sense of, well, you know, who are the people who get to determine what the best is? I mean, there's reasons why they chose the ones that they do. It's not like there's a conflict of interest or anything like that. I'm not getting money from it necessarily, but I can see why, you know, some people might balk at it.
It's a process, and the field is growing, and it's sort of self-improving slowly. And I guess the key is to try to find papers like this and other ways of, you know, catalyzing that sort of bootstrapping up of the field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it is progressing as far as that's concerned.
Yeah. I think it's a great development. And again, I've had, you know, fMRI prep, it doesn't radically change my results, but it does make them slightly stronger, more robust. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have no issues with it.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to back up a little bit, and because I think actually people are not completely, I should have even started with this, but aware of specifically what sort of materials you have out there. And mm-hmm. Maybe if you could summarize, you know, what's on your website, and now you have a brain blog, but also a brain book that you're developing.
Yes.
So might as well just mention everything.
Yeah, I'll start with the ebook. It's called Andy's Brain Book. It's hosted on Read the Docs, and I started that back in early 2019, just after I started working here at the University of Michigan. And the idea behind that, the blog was more informal, like I was saying, kind of like what was on my mind that particular week. You may notice that the writing style is much more informal, and it's, you know, heavily influenced by Dave Barry, who was a humor writer that I really liked. But the ebook is more systematic. It's designed to get people started with whatever package they're using. So obviously there's the big three. There's AFNI, SPM, FSL for fMRI preprocessing. There are new tools for diffusion, like MR tricks, for example. There are toolboxes for MVPA, machine learning. And there's also a few other modules on other tools you may come across that are useful, like MRI Crow GL, Chris Rorden's tool, excellent for not just converting DICOM files, but also visualization, and ITK Snap Slicer. You know, it's just kind of things I've also come across over the years. So yeah, the main focus is, again, just very systematic, starting out with, okay, assuming that, you know, you are somewhat new to this, you know, depending where you're at. Okay, if you don't know Unix, here's a Unix primer. And it's written with the goal of, at some point, you're going to be doing fMRI analysis. So I deliberately avoid certain topics in Unix that I think might not be as relevant to somebody who is really just using it to analyze fMRI data.
Yeah.
And so building it up like that. And then also within the ebook, what I found is really useful to have it in that particular format is it's very easy to cross-reference between different tools and different concepts. So for example, once I get through, just kind of start to finish analyzing the same data set, actually, nothing complicated. It's incongruent versus congruent. Okay, we know we're going to get this really robust congruency effect in the anterior cingulate cortex. Here's how you do preprocessing in SPM, AFNI, FSL. Here's how you do the modeling. Okay, then at that point, we have these new concepts like ROI analysis. So there might be another chapter, how do you do ROI analysis in each of these three? Slightly different, you know, ways to approach that. There might be this concept of, you know, inflated false positives from things like, some of the correction mechanisms, for example, in SPM, maybe leading to inflated false positives. There's that whole Eklund paper, which again, in general is good. I think it might've spooked people a little bit too much. And now if you don't do 0.001, people just, you know, on the face of it, which I think is not good, but in any case, but just taking that concept and saying, okay, well, here is a way to address that. Make sure you're not falling into that trap in AFNI, SPM, FSL. Here's non-parametric tests. Here's threshold-free cluster enhancement. So really trying to cover a lot of different scenarios you may come across and how to navigate them successfully. Again, you know, obviously there are certain things that we agree on that you really should not do. But beyond that, I try to give different perspectives of why you might want to use like maybe a certain threshold versus another, one smoothing kernel versus another, you know, probabilistic versus binary atlases. You know, it's really, there's many different choices people can make. And I try to provide, first of all, just give them a template to work with so they can use that, something I use and find, you know, to my taste, but also give them options to be flexible.
That's awesome. And I saw that. Well, one thing about the book and one thing that struck me is like, oh, wow, that's a really nice layout. So in terms of creating that website, I mean, sort of, I'm kind of curious what tools you kind of go to in terms of creating all these materials. I mean, though your videos are just amazingly produced.
Thank you. And
just the book itself, it looked like, is that like a Jupyter notebook that's sort of like put on? How do you do that?
I mean, it's not a Jupyter notebook, which I've only gotten into Jupyter notebooks relatively recently. And that's another trend I see in the field, which I can get into later. Yeah. This is the ebook is built on the programming language Sphinx, which I had not encountered before until 2019. And it's built through my GitHub page.
Okay.
So I write out all the texts, all the code to display figures and so on in GitHub, then I commit the changes and it's then reflected on the read the docs page.
Okay.
So yeah, maybe I should make actually a tutorial about how I did that, because I think that particular format, again, it's for me is easiest to read. I think I came across some other read the docs about, I forget what, but that I knew that that was the format that I wanted to use, something like that. And now with Jupyter Notebooks, again, that's also really useful because people can run it in their web browser and you get kind of instant feedback when you run code. So that's something else I really want to pursue.
Yeah.
As far as the videos, that I've stuck with Camtasia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to put in a plug for it. It is a commercial software. If you're a student, you may be able to get it for free. At least Michigan, they, Adobe Creative Cloud, you can get all that for free. And it is useful for my purposes. It has most of the effects that I use. So I was never trained in video production or anything. And a lot of this is kind of on the fly. But just to give you a sense of what I do these days. So everything, first of all, everything is scripted. So I write out an entire, Word document. I have it on one screen as I'm talking to the microphone. I do a lot of takes. And for the most part, especially with the ebook, it's mostly following what I wrote. So, maybe some variation here and there because some things sound better spoken than they read on the page, for example. But it mainly follows those lines. And then in post-production, Camtasia you can use to do the screen capture, which is kind of the workhorse of just showing people what to do. Then in post-production in Camtasia, it's zooming around, highlighting things, fading out to show maybe animations and so on and so forth. And one of the inspirations for that, something I try to do is, with books, for example, let's say you're reading, the McCarthy Huttle fMRI.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which a lot of people may have come across and are in the fourth edition or something. But I first started reading that when I was doing my lab manager position. And what I thought was, you have panel A and panel B on the page. I'll say before and after normalization, right? What I thought was, wouldn't it be useful is, given computers we have today, what we can do in video production is you can kind of show what happens between A and B. Like there's a process. The images get moved around a little bit. Maybe they need to be translated or zoomed or sheared, for example, before we can match this template. And here's how it happens. So that's what I'm using. And just one final thing is I'm trying to use Adobe Final Cut Pro now. I'm trying to kind of increase the video production quality. The past 5 years, I think just kind of YouTube in general has gotten, the level has increased quite a bit. I'm trying to stay current with it because...
So that's very cool. That's very cool. So, my question is, all this stuff, how much time, for instance, per week are you spending on just producing this, which is all free, by the way?
Yes. And I'm assuming it's going to remain free for, I do consulting and, it's gratifying to have people find me through materials and then earn money on the side with that. But yeah, the materials themselves, I have no intention of putting them behind a paywall.
Yeah.
The amount of time I spend on it. So with the past, let's say year and a half, I've been studying more just kind of video production methods. I'm kind of the next set of videos we'll be releasing are going to be looking different. So just stay tuned, everybody. I haven't totally dropped off the face of the planet yet, but I spend on those materials in particular, it's with my duties at the university, it's probably 50 to 60% is consulting for people here at the university.
Yeah.
And let's say another 25% of that is, teaching the course, also helping out with the annual fMRI course here at Michigan.
Yeah.
And I'm looping into consulting, also helping write grants and helping write experiments and things like that. I don't collect my own data anymore. I'm just helping people here at Michigan publish their papers, which is fine by me. And then the last quarter is continuing to update the ebook and also produce new videos. So, and lately it's included a lot of kind of going back to the drawing board, reviewing fundamentals of, Adobe After Effects, Adobe Photoshop. And to be honest, I think a really rich field to Ho would be to teach people how to, you know, create figures for manuscripts.
Yeah.
You know, that was never something I really learned. Really a lot of trial and error, but then you see these beautiful pictures and nature and science and everybody, that's kind of what everybody aspires to.
Yeah.
So I think that'd be really useful for just like a, kind of an intro. Like, first of all, here's a really nice figure that encapsulates everything they're doing. Very clear. It's not ambiguous at all. There's nothing distracting. What did they do exactly? And let's try to replicate that. And then given your data or given something that we download from online, okay, there's like some question we're trying to answer. Let's put our brain images together, put our results together, and try to compose it in a certain way that is attractive and informative.
Yeah, and I think it's all really all part of this sort of iteration of understanding the data. If you figure out how to display it in the best possible way, you know, you can probably get it in, you know, you conceptualize it better in terms of the best way, you know, how to display it. But it seems that also there's, I was going to mention, you know, as I saw this and I thought about, okay, you know, when I try to teach people in my group, when I try to, you know, at least, give them advice, there's people who, you know, who are just talented and, and they ask the right questions, they give beautiful talks. And if they don't know something, they just kind of figure it out. They go and, you know, they download AFNI and then work with it and figure it out. And but there are people who actually know all the tools really well, but then can't really either give a good talk or don't really ask the right questions. And don't have a certain amount of tenacity about their data to sort of probe into it deeply. And so it'd be interesting, actually. I mean, I'm not going to tell you, any ways to go, but I think there's, I wrote down some other ways of, other things to teach, like, you know, like you mentioned, how to make a good figure, but it also could be how to give a good talk, how to write a good paper, how to, read papers critically, how to ask good questions.
Well, regarding writing and to a certain extent speaking, whether it's for a talk or teaching a class, one author that had a big influence on me was Jacques Barzin, who I hadn't heard about until maybe 10 years ago. But he was a French-American historian. He passed away about 10 years ago. But he wrote a lot, not just on history. He did some biographies on William James and the composer Berlioz, but he also wrote a lot about education. And he's a fantastic writer, and he talks a lot about kind of the obligation as someone in academia to, you know, to the best of your ability. And again, some people are naturally gifted writers, but maybe not good speakers, and vice versa, for example. And somebody who has both is very, very fortunate. But he provides so many, you know, case studies from his experience and just, you know, excerpts from either, you know, novels or Supreme Court decisions, or even, I think he provided a good example of writing from, it was a textbook about how to saw, right? How to do carpentry. He said, listen, I mean, this is just clear prose, which is what we demand from everybody, but we don't always do it ourselves. Let's get into some of the mechanics and let's get into some of the style, because it's really gratifying, not just for the audience, but also for yourself, when you're able to really hone something through good craftsmanship and put your own fingerprints on it. So that's, again, someone who really spoke to me, but I'm regardless of whether you read them or not, those principles really stuck with me. And also, I think I may have written about this several years ago. Maybe I'm confabulating, but I'll just say it here. Whenever you're, you know, giving a talk, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, let's call it an hour. You're scheduled to give an hour talk. And you may not be the most comfortable speaking publicly. That's fine. But you also need to acknowledge that there's a responsibility that let's say there's 20 people in, you know, some conference room that everybody knows at the university, and they've all given you an hour of their time. Yep. And this could go one way, that you could leave them with something that they take away from it, and they're happy they attended. And the ideal talk, they're actually kind of sad when it ends, right? So that's the great way to go with that, right? So you could be up here, or you could be below where they were when they came into the room, and they could be either very bored or confused, but you have the ability to push that one way or the other. Now, again, I'm very sympathetic to people who have, you know, a difficult time talking or feeling comfortable standing up in front of people. But again, to the best of your ability and just through preparation, you can make it something that has a really strong multiplier effect if you put a lot of time into it. So that's something I encourage everybody to do. I don't have any like public speaking tips necessarily. That's not really my area of expertise. I'm fortunate that I feel comfortable talking in front of people. I don't really have a problem doing it. But yeah, just really try to cultivate that skill, even if, you know, it's not your favorite thing to do. It's still really important.
I definitely agree. I think a lot of people look at it as sort of like, you know, a lot of people, you know, as a secondary sort of thing. But in fact, all of science is really about communicating. And you know, it's at the end of the day, that's what we're doing. And it's about having a collective knowledge that sort of is pushing our collective understanding. We got to communicate well. Wanted to mention also, you also create a lot of workshops. I mean, I noticed that. Might as well talk about that a little bit.
Yes, they've been more frequent over the past year, fortunately, as you know, travel has become has picked back up. And yeah, I go to different universities across the country. This past spring, went to University of Washington, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and also University of Florida. And they were all different topics we're discussing. Some people just wanted an introduction to, I think one of them was just introduction to, you know, SPM. Another one was focused more on machine learning. One was focused on connectivity. But I always really enjoy those. You have such a different, you know, background in each of those areas. You know, some of them, you know, for example, much more student-driven. The people at Milwaukee, this is really just a student group that kind of organizes this and brings me in. Others like the University of Washington, it's much more from the faculty's perspective. But in any case, it's, you know, still very gratifying to do. And, you know, it's 2-3 days, usually something like that. And anytime that I travel to these places, you know, during informal periods, during breaks, when we're getting dinner, for example, I'm always really curious what, you know, people want to learn more about at their particular university. Some of them have maybe a really great functional connectivity core. You know, University of Pennsylvania, you have Danny Bassett, Rick Betzel, for example, a really good, you know, cognitive psychology program like at IU, maybe a really good machine learning core like at Dartmouth. I mean, they're stacked. It's absurd. And NIH obviously has a huge technical base across many, many different types of methods. And so it's interesting getting to know exactly, you know, what they feel their strengths are, what they feel kind of what they could use more help with. And it gives me a good idea about how to fill in the gaps of maybe, you know, what would have the most impact for the most people. And that's where I've been getting these ideas for analyzing things from like human connectome product, for example. I think anybody would really benefit from that. Yeah. So yeah, workshops, I love doing them. Thankfully, they've picked up in frequency recently. And yeah, that's a major part of what I like to do.
Yeah. Well, that's, and also, right, I think that you mentioned, I mean, yeah, you learn a lot, and it's sort of, it's once again, an iteration of experience that hones your skill, and you could keep on, you know, getting better and better as far as that's concerned. Mm-hmm. And actually along those lines, so I'm kind of curious, you know, right, if I were in your position, I would try to, you know, I think that what you're doing is gaining awareness and momentum in the field. Mm-hmm. But so one is, you know, what sort of feedback it's probably overwhelmingly positive, but what sort of feedback have you received in general, and how how are you, aside from just, you know, having your websites, is it just, you know, how are you making more people aware? It seems like what you're doing could be something that, you know, you could tap into like OHBM and sort of have them, you know, say, hey, teach this, lead this sort of thing or whatever. I mean, yeah, the feedback and what you're doing to further disseminate this really, really valuable information.
The feedback has been positive. I'm always, you know, really grateful when I hear somebody has benefited from it. And I also, again, need to give a lot of credit to other people who have also done a lot of similar things to what I'm doing, but in you know, maybe slightly different fields. You know, Jeanette Mumford has a very more statistics focused set of resources, which again, I use a lot.
Yeah.
And more recently, to give another example, Talia Coney and Ariel Rokum wrote a Python for neuroimagers set of Jupyter notebooks, which also extremely useful. And I'm, in a lot of cases, I do, I'm not going to say steal, but I do take quite a bit of information from people who've already put it, you know, online. I try to give obviously credit where it's due, but yeah. You know, for example, I mean, with the AFME materials, I'm really just kind of recapping in a different way what has already been written there and what I learned from the workshops.
Yeah.
What I think is going to make it even more useful and to reach an even wider audience, obviously, you know, YouTube is a great way to disseminate this information, and I'm going to keep running with it. Something I'm also working on right now is doing interviews with people. So kind of similar to what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
Because last fall, I created a video. It's kind of an internal video for prospective graduate students that are applying to the one of the areas in the psychology department here at Michigan. And part of that was just, you know, walking around, like renting out a camera, walking around campus, getting shots, talking to people, you know, putting together this 5-minute kind of promo video. And I'm making them for the other parts as well. And so like what I was talking about with tapping more into the history of certain methods. So something I have in mind, just to give an example where my head's at, I think it'd be really useful to go to some place like Dartmouth, which has people like Jim Haxby, Luke Chang, Emily Finn, really well-known machine learning experts. And, you know, first of all, this might sound a little weird, but almost kind of like a travel vlog where, you know, okay, we're here at Dartmouth.
Yeah.
Here's what's going on here. You may not have known this, but they have a very, very stacked, talented machine learning team. And we have here Jim Haxby, I just went to reunion and I found out he went to my college, which I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
And he was being honored with some distinguished lifetime thing. I didn't get to talk to him, but I thought that was interesting. But anyway, we could say here, we're talking with Jim Haxby, who is one of the founders of MVPA. And, you know, just to talk about what was going through your mind in, you know, the late 1990s, early 2000s, as you were coming up with this method. What are you doing now? Like, who else is involved in this? What are the clinical applications and so on and so forth? And then also another thing I think is very useful along the same vein of using these kind of large open access data sets, which include things like ADNI, which include things like Abide, which looks at, you know, persons with autism, for example. Addressing it more from the clinical angle, which is not my particular field, it is also going to be really interesting, not just for researchers, but for the general public. So the way I'm trying to slightly alter the training materials, we'll see how well this works, is to first start off with the history, which anybody can you know, look at and enjoy, for example. You could be part of the general public and you're like, oh, this is what's happening with my tax dollars. Here's all this great stuff that's happening in research. And then beyond that, you say, okay, now this is more for somebody who is interested in that field. And maybe you're an incoming clinical researcher trying to work with fMRI and you have data with lesions in it. You have these big patches of cortex which have a tumor on it, or maybe they're missing parts of cortex. What do you do for registration and normalization? That's, you know, kind of a big question mark for them. So that's how I want to, you know, take my next steps. I think that's the next evolution of the materials that I'm making.
That's so making it more like a right. Yeah, definitely. I think people resonate with, you know, sort of having a story, having context, having, you know, history, and talking. Right. I love that idea of going to universities and just getting a sense of the lab. And because I think actually people, I mean, certainly the intellectual material can be filtered and put forth in a very clear way. But at the same time, right, people, the way people work is that they sort of, you know, it's we're still humans after all. And so we kind of, we resonate with these stories. We resonate with the people. And so that's so cool.
Yeah. And like you, for example, you were on kind of the ground floor when like fMRI was being born, right?
With
Jack W. and those people. And for people like me who weren't around at the time, I mean, this is really interesting. It's important to know, to know where this came from. And it was an exciting time, I'm sure.
Yeah. It was a completely exciting time. And yeah, when I talk about it, I always have fun. But also I always try to, you know, the message that I try to say is not necessarily, I mean, certainly it ends up, you know, teaching people about contrast mechanisms and things like that, but more, you know, I think that more people, I think, would benefit from learning about, you know, the process. And I was kind of lucky. I was sort of like in the right time, the right place. But I also feel that, and with any aspect of the field, that the process of kind of being faced with, you know, what, not knowing, you know, what to do, or, and being comfortable with the idea of just trying things and exploring and asking questions and trying to, you know, a lot of people think that if they just kind of do the analysis and whatever, I think that they'll get the results, but there's no sense of like, I really want to find something new. I want to develop something brand new that people don't necessarily agree with, that we might try. And and so the iteration of trying things, I think that's what I try to convey when I talk about those historical times, is that, you know, we were just, you know, we were building grating coils. I was trying to figure out ways of looking at brain function. And, you know, I saw this hint of something from the MGH group, and we just did it. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons not to do it, but then we just did it and it kind of worked. And
that's how it goes.
Yeah. That's how it goes. And so anyway, so I think, teaching, and once again, and maybe, you know, this touches upon the concept of, you know, what can you really teach easily, and what's harder to teach? Teaching people to be more bold and confident and asking, you know, certain types of questions is hard, is a really hard thing, because it sort of taps into people's personalities and, you know,
it's true. Things you can teach, obviously the mechanics, I think that's available to anybody with the right motivation, which you'd assume, you know, most graduate students fall into that category. And also, like I said, I'm hoping that with things like teaching people basics of figure composition and writing, there's also, I think, certain fundamentals that, and I'm not talking about, you know, the ABCs or grammar or anything like that, but just, you know, some of the basics of style and trying to get inside the head of the reader and the viewer can really help. But the intangibles, as you said, there's certain personalities that just seem to really have an affinity for wrestling with scientific questions and really seeing them from all different angles. And that's something that really struck me again with Derek when I was coming up with, you know, some experiments of my own. You know, he was pretty rigorous in asking, like, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I think once I got to Michigan and I met John Janitas, who was his advisor, it kind of clicked. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, so you know, there's something to be said for pedigree. You know, people who are in certain labs, there's certain ways of thinking that are passed down, which are kind of hard to replicate if you're not in that lab.
Yeah.
It's worth thinking about, because obviously if we all have people who are very critically minded and are able to see all the angles, so much the better. I think that'll really elevate the field, but I can't say I know anything about how to teach that exactly.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. It really is. But I think you're right. I think it can be, it's sort of incorporated in a lab, the culture. I realize, you know, as I try to run my lab, it's like, I realize that, you know, I was lucky when I was in graduate school, Jim Hyde was my advisor, and he had this style of just sort of like being very hands-off, but every once in a while throwing out some sort of insight and direction and sort of tweaking. Yeah. And I realized I sort of have incorporated that myself without really even knowing it, as I always thought that that's how you do things. That's, you know, some lab directors are very like, well, this is the project, this is what you're going to do. Yeah. You know, it's very, and they both, you know, some work better than others, but it's interesting. And so I've learned that without really consciously, you know, it's not something I learned consciously. It's sort of like a process. And so maybe certain things take longer periods of time.
You know, aside from, you know, a certain culture of thinking maybe being passed down, I would say, you know, to anybody who's listening to this, you know, if there is another skill that you're good at, could be athletics, could be playing an instrument, what have you, you know, think about that as well. You know, what goes into becoming proficient at that? Could be swimming or playing tennis, or, you know, something that came to my mind. I'm by no means a composer, and I never really played any of my compositions for people, but you know, I play piano, and I've studied a little bit of composition and counterpoint, and it's really, really difficult to write something in the classical style that follows the rules of, you know, voice leading, counterpoint, harmony. Just writing a convincing 8-bar phrase is extremely difficult, and, you know, gain a lot of appreciation for how some of the greats could do it. And so if you start thinking in that way, that, you know, there's a certain, you know, training and balance and craftsmanship that goes into really any of these, there's a common thread. And if you start looking at writing, you know, say scientific writing that you really admire, you probably pick up that, you know, there is a lot of intention about how they're trying to get a certain effect across. Yeah.
Yes.
That's really worth thinking about. And, you know, you will gain a lot of appreciation and a lot of skill the more that you think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You really bring up a good point with other skills. And I won't belabor this point more, but you made me think about how, like, for instance, you know, I ran in college, and having a coach, you know, like having a, you know, right now, you know, yes, the equivalent of a coach is sort of like a mentor or something like that in science. But you could almost imagine, you know, if you're like, instead of being like a consultant or you could potentially be, you know, because there's a lot of, like, now it's becoming a big thing with people running that you have online coaches, and they prescribe workouts and things like that. And you could almost take that model and, you know, in the context of fMRI or doing science, you could be an fMRI coach, and you can give them drills or things to do or feedback. And
that's a big part of what I'm doing now. I mean, I try to add continually exercises to the ebook that try to, you know, not just recap what you've done and make sure you can use the SPM GUI, but, you know, like, what do you think would happen if you did such and such, and why? Okay, well, now do it and see whether it matches with what you expected. And yeah, that's a lot of what we do in the course that I'm teaching. So yeah, I mean, you know, the analogy with, say, sports, for example, you know, it's not perfect, but it really does get to the heart of the matter, in that, you know, you really do need to train and be consistent and think about form, for example. It's all intertwined. I mean, people respond to someone who is really, you know, competent, and, you know, you kind of gravitate towards certain people. Like with statistics, for example, that's one of my weak points. And when I read, you know, say, like, you know, Jeanette's papers or see her videos, I can tell that she has a handle on it that I, you know, I'm trying to emulate.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's interesting to try to harness that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I realized this hour and 20 some minutes has flown by.
Okay, yeah.
But let me just try to end with, I mean, you already gave sort of advice to young researchers. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe, if you had any additional advice for young researchers starting in the field.
Well, like I said, if you're not that certain or that sure about exactly what it is, you know, you want to do, but you do find yourself gravitating towards more the academic lifestyle and the ability to ask questions and pursue them, you know, I can only speak for experience, but 2 years as a lab manager was perfect for me. And just taking the time to be around people at different stages of their careers to see what they go through and whether it's something you might like to do, for example, and also to establish contacts.
Yeah.
And beyond that, with, you know, really writing is, you know, your bread and butter as an academic. So is speaking. And both of those skills, however you can, and I can't really provide you any, you know, tutorials or resources on that aside from, you know, some of the authors I mentioned. Those are things that you're going to be using your entire life. And the more that you think about it as something that is really intentionally cultivated, I really think not just the more benefit you'll get, but just the more pleasure you'll get doing it. I can also speak from experience that the more you write, the more pleasurable it becomes really to edit it. I mean, editing is my favorite part. I'm not a fan of putting things down initially. Once you get past that and you're chipping away at things and transposing things here and there, it becomes something very, very gratifying.
Yeah, I totally agree. You get it quickly into a flow state and in some sense, sort of like after the words are down, then you edit and you have something there. And so you're not like totally out there. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like programming in that regard too, where you get this feedback when you compile it and try it and having a little bit of feedback like that and seeing how things go. Yeah, it's just...
Yes. And lastly, you know, it can be, there's some randomness, obviously, to who your advisor is, what lab you end up in. You know, when you're first starting out, it's not always clear who you exactly want to work with, what personalities will mesh. And I've seen it go both ways. And it's not always somebody's fault. It's just there's a mismatch in, you know, perspective or personalities. You know, just be aware of it. Try not to take things too personally if it goes wrong. And in my experience, you know, the vast majority of people are operating in good faith. They want you to succeed. And it can take some time, some adjustment, not only to figure out who you mesh best with, but also to figure out yourself, how you work best and what environment you work the best in. And again, it's easy for me to say now, kind of having been, I'm out the other side of graduate school and being a postdoc. I had a very supportive environment in graduate school. And as a postdoc, it doesn't always go that way, but so this might be easy for me to say, but, you know, really ask for what you want. You know, if you don't ask, you're never going to get it. So
yeah,
it's tough. I have a lot of sympathy for people who do have a more difficult time than I did, but that's the best advice I can give.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it is a hard process, but it's mm-hmm. good advice. Last question. So where do you see things going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Good question. Yes. As we've talked about these larger open access data sets, I think just being fluent with them, being able to use them, and being able to use computing clusters, I think 5 to 10 years is going to be required.
Yeah.
For graduate students to know how to do that. Python seems to be, it has the most cachet, the most prestige. I'm still becoming comfortable with it. You know, it's not my first language, programming language. But I definitely see the utility as far as Jupyter Notebooks and these packages they have. I think everybody is going to need to have at least some familiarity with that going forward. As far as the modalities, for example, I don't think fMRI is, you know, going anywhere anytime soon. As in, I think it's, you know, here to stay for quite a good deal longer, especially as, you know, temporal resolution becomes a little bit sharper, spatial resolution becomes a little bit sharper. I kind of on my periphery, again, this isn't something I'm that familiar with, but you know, transcranial brain stimulation, you know, a TMS, for example, ITBS, I believe has a tremendous potential in explaining causal mechanisms about how the brain works. Again, I'm really not speaking from direct experience, but more peripherally, people I talk to, things I see. I believe it holds great promise, especially with treating certain clinical disorders. I saw a really interesting new technique out of, I think it was Stanford, I believe, one of the groups in Stanford, where you use functional connectivity to identify kind of deficits in connectivity compared to, you know, controls. And yep. This is working with depressed patients. And then stimulating that region with TBS, and you get just as good gains, just as sustained gains as you do with electroconvulsive therapy, which is astounding to me, which is great. Yeah. No anesthesia, non-invasive. It's not generalized shocking. So I think that's also very interesting avenue for the future.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Okay, well, this has been awesome. And I just like to thank you for spending the time and wish you the best in the future.
Peter, thank you so much again for having me. I enjoy this tremendously. Yeah.
Neurosalience is brought to you by the Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode was produced by Alfie Wine and Farouk Golban.